The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Listeners, on behalf of Rob Terrio and Bill Toon, this is Greg Fries for the EMS Educast. As always, we're thrilled to have you listening and sharing our episodes on Facebook and Twitter and Google Plus and writing blog posts about them and mentioning episodes in staff meetings or newsletters that you send out. But please continue to help us to share the word with 180 plus episodes of the EMS Educast. We've covered really all sorts of EMS education topics and people and books and events and techniques and how to. And so don't be afraid to dig through the archives at emseducast.com, or of course you could go to the ProMed Network and listen there, or iTunes, and I'm pretty sure we're still on Stitcher, and there's all sorts of ways that you can listen to the EMS Educast, and then of course continue to share it. Just lots and lots of goodness that we're glad to have made available for you, and we always appreciate the feedback we get back from you. Rob, I seem to have increasing difficulty speaking. I'm not sure what's happening.
I want you to lift both arms up and close your eyes, and let me know if one begins to drift.
Well, it might be hard for me to perceive that as happening, but you're in the midst of midterms or final exams or something?
Nope, just finished our midterms. We just had our reading week, and so now we're back for the final 7 weeks of the semester. So
okay.
But, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask if you had to send anyone packing after the midterms.
No. Okay. There are no midterm graduates. You go through the whole semester, whether you're doing poorly or not. But
All right.
So far, so good. We had another great group of students this year. But I want to tell our Canadian listeners that I was at the Interac Paramedic Conference in Manitoba this weekend, which was fantastic. Great conference. What was really interesting about the conference is a number of provinces in Canada. We have two provinces rather that are self-regulation, paramedic self-regulation, Saskatchewan and New Brunswick. And Ontario, Manitoba, and Nova Scotia are pursuing self-regulation. Alberta is regulated, not yet self-regulated, which is interesting. But what was great about this conference is I met with the executive CEO for the Emergency Health Service Branch and the province's medical director, and they are both very strongly in support of paramedic self-regulation, which is quite a departure from Ontario. So I thought our Canadian listeners would like to hear that.
Well, great. Thanks for the Canada update. I was just a few miles from the Canadian border over the weekend. I was in Vermont at the Vermont EMS conference at the Jay Peak Ski Resort, and my cell phone kept sending me messages that I was out of country and now roaming at maximum charges possible. And
It does that when you're close to the border. Yeah. Same with us on this side of the border. Oh, and I also saw Chris Montera and Ann Robinson and Gary Wingrove were speaking at the conference in Manitoba. So, yeah, it was great. Good to see those guys.
Reunion. Fantastic. Well, Bill, have you had any adventures or travels lately?
No. My greatest travel is to make it to the dog park with the dog, and that's my – I enjoy doing that as much as possible, except the rain we're having the last couple of days has certainly put a damper on those experiences and stuff. But nope, I won't be traveling till for a couple of weeks, and I'm going to save that to bring up at the end of the discussion. But otherwise, things are good. And Rob, that's excellent information to hear about self-regulation. I really do hope at some point here in the States we can follow a similar model as done with the other professional practices.
Mm-hmm. And great progress that you're making as well.
Yeah, and it's really happening globally. We're seeing it happen in Australia and the UK and other parts of the world. Very exciting. we're really starting to grow into our independence.
Fantastic. Well, we do have a guest tonight, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Mike Stern. Mike is the training specialist for the EMS program at the National Fire Academy, and we'll let him introduce himself more. But this was a suggestion from a listener, a graduate that completed maybe several programs now at the National Fire Academy, and that said, oh, it'd be great to have Mike on and share with the EMS Educast listeners the great things that are going on at the National Fire Academy. And by national, I mean the United States National Fire Academy, because our listeners are all over the world, and it could be that there's more than one National Fire Academy depending on where you're from. But Mike, welcome to the EMS Educast.
Thank you, Greg. I'm happy to be here.
Well, so we're real glad to have you. The four of us have never met face-to-face, but so we don't know much about you and the work you do. So if you could, you know, we've got plenty of time here. If you could really sort of look back on your career and talk to us about how you got started in fire and EMS and your education and different work stops along the way, and all sort of building up to where you're at now.
Okay. I started as a volunteer firefighter and EMT in Prince George's County, Maryland, one of the busier systems in the area, in a combined career and volunteer system, combined fire and EMS system. I was a volunteer in a volunteer station with some career personnel supplementing from the county. And I started doing that because I was bored one day, went in and said, how can I help people? And they were very quick to show me an ambulance and lead me to training, to which I took a liking and started doing more and more. I spent 10 years active duty as a U.S. Navy corpsman, which provided a state general duty and had a lot of great experiences learning primary care, emergency care, pharmacology, preventive medicine, shipboard medicine versus hospital medicine, et cetera. And the whole time I was doing that, I was able to volunteer, almost the whole time I was able to volunteer as a firefighter or an EMT somewhere in the country near where I was stationed, and then get myself through paramedic school eventually. Then I was able to volunteer as a paramedic in a local rescue squad in Virginia while I was stationed in Naval Medical Center, Portsmouth, Virginia. That led to teaching for the paramedic school I had graduated from, because I had already been doing ALS in the Navy. So I was an ACLS instructor, a PHTLS instructor, all those fun things in the service, but I couldn't do it outside the gates until I got the civilian versions. Went back and started teaching for the paramedic school I graduated from. That led to a friend who knew a friend, and I ended up getting out of the Navy to take a position as the training director for Summit County Ambulance in Colorado, where, as we know, our world is small. You mentioned Chris Montero. We work together in Summit County.
Wow, excellent. It's a small world.
It is. He was doing, at that time, he was a part-time paramedic, but his primary mission with us was data management and getting EPCRs up and running before the acronym EPCR was really taking off.
He still looks like he's 18.
Yes.
Nothing's changed.
So we worked out there while I was in Summit County. I ended up doing some part-time work next door in Grand County and switched counties after a while, and left Grand County EMS as the county deputy EMS chief and the county emergency manager. And that county was interesting. The county's emergency management service was assigned to the EMS chief, which in good turn was delegated to the deputy. So I got to learn a whole lot about emergency management and disaster planning, and that side of our public safety world. It was while I was in Summit County, I learned about the National Fire Academy. Oddly enough, and we're finding that, unfortunately, this is very true across the country, I grew up in Prince George's County, Maryland, an hour and a half from the National Fire Academy in Emmitsburg, Maryland. I had no clue it existed until I moved to Summit County, Colorado,
And my chief there, Sean Caffrey, said, hey, you should go back home to the National Fire Academy. So he introduced me to that. I took several classes at National Fire Academy and Emergency Management Institute, eventually applied for a position because it sounded good. I liked the campus. And on a miracle, my dad says I filled out the forms right. I was able to earn a position at the National Fire Academy with the EMS program.
You went in and became a volunteer, and then you joined the Navy, or you were a Navy Corps? So how old were you when you started, I guess, and did I get the chronology right?
I was. You did. I started volunteering fire and EMS first. I was 20 years old at the time.
Okay.
And while I was doing that, I ended up joining the Navy. Our local recruiter was a volunteer in the next fire station north of us. And we got to talking one day, and one thing led to another, and I joined the Navy.
Okay. And did you have quite a few overseas deployments, and what kind of...
I did. I went in. I signed up for the Navy. Our friend in Iraq invaded Kuwait. Okay. Then I went to boot camp, and I went straight from boot camp to Desert Storm aboard the battleship Wisconsin.
All right.
In order to assist with that fun.
Well, I cheer that because I'm in Wisconsin, so that's
excellent.
Great to hear that you served aboard the battleship Wisconsin.
Is that in the USA, that Wisconsin place somewhere?
Yeah.
And then after that, I spent time in hospitals on a couple more ships. I did deploy overseas on a destroyer for a while, and then we were activated to go places and stood down for humanitarian missions, etc.
What kind of calls did you look after in the Navy? What kinds of things did you see?
I was lucky to get a variety. Within the hospitals, I was able to do primary care, ICU, CCU, step down, post-surgical, all those, on active duty and veterans and military dependents. I was able to work in a nuclear shipyard and get a start with hazmat and learn about nuclear decontamination and illness and radiation dangers.
Wow. What a great variety of experience. What about on board the ships? What kinds of things did you see? Kind of cases?
It pretty much everything except geriatric and pediatric.
Thank goodness, eh?
We had a nice, young, healthy crew. So it was a lot of trauma. It's an industrial environment. A ship is living in an industry 24 hours a day. So a lot of industrial type accidents, a lot of trauma. And then typical healthy people medical, allergic reactions, coughs, colds, sniffles, primary care type stuff. The best part of the experience was learning the primary care from initial assessment and triage through diagnosis, through prescribing the medication, following up with the patient to make sure they're compliant, and then seeing if it's actually working, making secondary assessments if necessary, doing the lab work if necessary, et cetera, and then seeing the patient through to healthy and going on their way.
That's excellent.
Was there college along the way, degrees?
I have a whole lot of loose college credits as I moved around and attended different colleges, some in the Navy while we were at sea and some stateside. And then after I got out of the Navy, I tried again stateside. But I seem to always put the job training, the professional training, the continuing education ahead of the college credits. So I have never wrapped all of it back together into a degree.
Huh. Are you getting some pressure in your position to get a degree?
It ebbs and tides. At times they bring it up and they discuss it, and other times it's not a high priority. A lot of that has to do with the work that we're producing is of reasonable enough, high enough quality that it's not a high pressure that I'm failing, okay. So I have to do more. I perceive it more as it would be nice if you did this because you haven't.
Okay. All right.
And so who are you teaching now, Mike? Are you teaching paramedics, EMTs, different levels?
We actually at the National Fire Academy have taken the approach in the EMS program that we're not doing any patient care provider education or training.
Okay.
Everyone out there does it. I mean, there are programs all over the country. Some of you are, as you were saying, are directly involved in programs. We're not going to duplicate those efforts because you already do it and you do it well.
So what's your role then?
We officially, the mission or the statute, whatever the right terminology is we're supposed to provide advanced emergency medical services training. And we've defined that as management level training rather than patient care training.
Okay. So incident command, unified command systems, those sorts of things?
Yes. On the incident command side, we're doing the medical components of multi-patient, multi-casualty, ICS. And then on the day-to-day operational side of it, we're doing things like QA/QI in our quality management program. We have a brand new research class. We have a straightforward management of EMS, which is an entry level. What are the parts and pieces to you're in charge of something now? What do you need to do from time management all the way through putting out requests for bids for equipment?
Okay, I'm curious if you have, and I'm trying to search for it as we're talking here, an app called Tactical EMS, and if you use that for tabletop exercises for disaster management, are you familiar with that app that I'm referring to?
I have heard of it, and I remember seeing it on the web or at a conference. I remember seeing it. We do not use it at the National Fire Academy. Everything we're doing is in-house and strict, since we are part of FEMA, strict ICS in its rawest forms.
Okay.
I guess my friends have gone to the National Fire Academy. It's typically a 1 or 2 week residential programs. Is that the case with the EMS side as well, or are there weekend courses or semesters or online courses? What's the sort of format of a course, and if it's easy to just pick one specific one and kind of lay out what the course is and what it involves, that'd be fine as well.
Okay, and the answer to the question is basically yes.
Okay.
We have a wide variety. On our campus, we typically run 1 week and 2 week, or 6 day and 10 day courses, which you come, you're a resident on our campus. We have an old college facility that we use with dorms, cafeteria, and everything. We also have 2 day courses that are hosted locally all over the country. And some of the states that host those courses use our facility to do it. The ones that are close, like Maryland, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Virginia, etc., they often use our facility to do those 2 day courses. Others, Colorado, Texas, do the 2 day courses in their states and host it locally. We also have online courses. NFA Online has a wide variety of certificate courses. Many of your listeners have probably taken NFA online courses through ICS or some of the other versions. We have recently started looking at doing college-style mediated online learning with 12-week semesters with an instructor-mediated process of five or six units, just like a college would go through a semester, and you have assigned readings and discussion boards and papers, et cetera. And we're just breaking into that arena. That's new to us, and we're testing a few things right now.
Just curious, what kind of learning management system do you use?
I honestly don't know the name of it. It is not Blackboard. I know that, but it is one of the LMSs that's out there for commercial use.
Okay. I hear CenterLearn is a fantastic platform.
Well,
like no other.
I'm familiar with CenterLearn, as having done some of my continuing education in outside world with CenterLearn.
And Mike, I don't know if you know this, but I'm the director of education for Centerlearn. So, Rob, I certainly appreciate the plug, but Mike, we're not. My intent wasn't to put you on the spot there, but thanks.
So Mike, before a little bit of the history of how the National Fire Academy maybe came to be, and then how it got into the realm of EMS from usually a more fire service oriented approach, if you have some of that background knowledge.
Okay, the U.S. Fire Administration came about in the early 70s after America Burning Report came out, and we needed to do something about prevention and stopping deaths from structure fires. So the U.S. Fire Administration was born to work on prevention, which included data collection, the NFERS program, which a lot of our fire listeners are submitting data to, whether they know it or not. And then the National Fire Academy was included as a piece of the fire administration to provide training to the fire service in initially the prevention aspects. Over the years, that grew into other parts and pieces that were deemed necessary, such as arson investigation, hazardous materials, command and control, et cetera. The executive fire officer program was born, and honestly, I don't remember what year, which is a master's level, a graduate level fire officer program, a step above our typical 2-week classes. And then in 2008, our fiscal year 2009, the reauthorization of the U.S. Fire Administration included for the first time in USFA's history the terminology NFA, National Fire Academy, shall provide advanced EMS training. There had been the management of EMS classes and a couple of other classes previous that were done quietly since the late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s. There were some classes done because somebody at that time realized, well, fire service has something to do with EMS. Many fire service agencies do a lot of EMS, but since it wasn't in law, they couldn't officially do it at that time. In 2008, it was written into the reauthorization, into the law, so we had to create a program from scratch. At that time, we were lucky enough to be able to bring in subject matter experts from across the country. We had two meetings. The first round was just subject matter experts from rural systems, urban systems, West Coast, East Coast, career, volunteer, paramedic, EMT, nurses, doctors, educators, etc. We brought them all into the room and basically asked them, what is it the NFA should do for advanced EMS training? Help us create a path. We got their opinion and then brought them back with representatives from most of our national associations, NAEMT, NAEMSE. I guess I shouldn't use acronyms as much here, should I? So the National Association of EMTs, the National Association of EMS Educators, National Association of State EMS Officials, International Association of Firefighters, International Association of Fire Chiefs, etc. As many as we could identify that had something to do with EMS, we brought together in addition to the subject matter experts and narrowed our path and decided we weren't going to duplicate what others were doing. We brought NHTSA in since NHTSA provides our EMS education standards. We brought Health and Human Services in since CDC and Health and Human Services does a lot of the prevention stuff. We wanted to make sure they were involved. And we came away with our definition of the mission based on all this input from the nation. And we've spent the last, that's 5 years ago now, we've spent the last 5 years evaluating what we had, starting to revise what we had, and creating a whole lot of new coursework based on that direction given to us of the management level EMS training.
It's been quite an undertaking, and you know, the formalizing of that role. So in this calendar year or fiscal year, whichever is easiest, like how many EMS managers and leaders will participate in courses?
That is a number I don't have off the top of my head.
I'd have to do math. Thousands, or I mean, what's the just ballpark?
In a good year, we'll get it. Right now, we'll get about 1,000. Part of my challenge is the fact that we're new.
Right.
Well, my huge challenge is we're new, and as I said, in my own experience, I grew up near here and didn't know the National Fire Academy existed. Many people across the country don't know it exists, let alone that it has an EMS program. So I'm challenged with, hey, we have a program, come see us. And at the same time, we're challenged with all the challenges you have across the country of short staffing, short budgets, travel restrictions, et cetera. So we're seeing all those same challenges that impact the numbers of a new program trying to grow.
And so if I'm a supervisor or a deputy chief at a service somewhere, like, can I just call up and sign up for a course, or do I have to be invited or somehow like determined eligible?
Or do you have to be part of a fire-based EMS service, or can you be separate?
It's actually real easy. On our website at www.usfa.dhs.gov/NFA, on the website, you can search by program, or if you know course codes, or just put in generic terms, or there are a lot of ways to get to it. You can look at the EMS courses as well as the arson and the hazmat and everything else. Look at the EMS courses, and in each course, there's a description of the course, and there's a student selection criteria to tell you what the prerequisites are, what rank or position description or job description or what would make you eligible for the course. Some of them have prerequisites. Some of them simply, you have to have some responsibility, like the ICS courses. You have to have some responsibility for implementing ICS on a mass casualty incident. And that ranges by your definition, not ours. The application information is also on the website, as the forms. We are the federal government. You do have to fill out a form by hand. I think they've recently updated it to allow you to type into a PDF. And your chief of the agency, what a director of your department, whatever you call it, signs off as the head person for the agent representing the agency. And you can fax the application into our admissions office. We have open enrollment times. We kind of run a semester system. Right now, that is open for the next semester. We go October 15th through December 15th. We take applications for our second semester, which is April through September. We take those applications, the admissions department, just like a college, sorts them, evaluates all the selection criteria, prerequisites, all that fun stuff, and then put students in the classes. We attempt to spread the class population across the country in any given class, so that when you come to the National Fire Academy, a class of 25 students hopefully is representing 25 different jurisdictions across the country, and we can have that networking of California does it very different than Vermont does it, very different than Texas does it, et cetera.
That would make it very appealing, I would think. That'd be really interesting to do that kind of networking.
Yes, it's as a student, it was excellent, and now as the training specialist, to be able to watch students come in on day one thinking they have all these problems that they're here to solve, and by the end of the week or 2 weeks, they realize all 25 students really have the same problems, just in a different priority order, and some have figured some of those things out, and they leave sharing, how did you solve it? I'm going to steal that idea and apply it this way to my agency because you already figured it out in a different area of the country.
Yeah, there's nothing better than an educational opportunity where you learn as much from the class as you do from your peers.
I'm going to tell you that having had the opportunity to go to the Fire Academy on at least two occasions for 2 weeks programs, I would say that that was the strongest part of the program, is meeting these people from many different places in the United States and seeing the issues that they're dealing with and how they dealt with them. And it was really amazing. And the strength of the program is this chance to work with all of these different people. It's quite wonderful and a great experience. Just, it's well worth it.
And Mike, do you ever get students from outside of the U.S., Canada, Europe, other places?
We do on occasion. Because we're part of the federal government, specifically Department of Homeland Security, there are restrictions on non-U.S. citizens being on our campus. But it is possible. We've actually had executive fire officer graduates from Hong Kong, Australia, England, and others. I don't recall them all, but it is possible.
Yeah, I went to school with a gentleman that was from Hong Kong in the ambulance service there.
Right. Oh, and that brings up back to your question, Greg, regarding do you have to be a firefighter or representing a fire department? No, you do not. Obviously, most of our students are fire service because we're the National Fire Academy. However, we have law enforcement in the arson classes. We have Red Cross personnel in the prevention classes, in the safety classes. And in the EMS program, technically the program is open to any EMS person that is eligible for that particular class. If you're coming to an ICS class, if you implement ICS stepping off of your ambulance, whether it's hospital-based, third service, whatever that might be, you're eligible. As long as you meet those requirements.
Even if you're a private for profit?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well.
I'll give you the one difference. You're eligible to take the class.
Right.
The class is at no cost. Your tax dollars pay for our creation of these classes. The difference in funding, because the federal government, through the fire service at least, doesn't give money to private for-profit entities.
Right.
The difference is you would have to pay for your dormitory lodging and you would have to pay for your own transportation if you are not state or local government personnel. That's not fire EMS, that's government personnel.
So, Mike, were you recently furloughed because of the government shutdown?
Yes, I was.
That must have been a painful experience.
It was very interesting for the first time in my life being told you're not allowed to work.
Mm-hmm.
I have never been told don't work.
That would be a shock. And did it throw off the schedules? Were you able to get back on track, or has everything been sort of pushed back now?
Unfortunately, it did create about a month interruption because we had to cancel classes. We had classes in session the day we closed on October 1st, so we had to get those students home. And those students... most of those students will have to come back and repeat their class because they didn't finish. They didn't meet the objectives. And then we had to cancel the next couple of sessions because we weren't going to be there to offer them or to contact them to bring them in at a later date. They're attempting to reschedule all of those students, but it's going to be somewhat hit or miss as they adjust schedules, et cetera.
That's sad. It was interesting. I was listening to a radio talk show today about science studies that were canceled during the government shutdown, and how in some instances there were projects on the go, and as a result of having to cancel them, they cannot be rescheduled for at least another year, you know, like work in the Antarctic and things like that, where there's a very narrow window of opportunity to do that kind of research work. So I feel bad for you guys, for Americans who were subject to that shutdown, something which you had no control over. But things are getting back on track there now, are they?
Yes, they are. For the students, we get back in swing this coming Sunday. We'll pick right back up with regularly scheduled classes as though nothing had happened. For the work in the background, the curriculum management, building the courses, revising the courses, all that fun stuff. Luckily, the majority of it, we could just stop work, set it aside, come back, pick up exactly where we left off for the most part. Because it's administrative in nature. It's creating curriculum.
That could be a whole ICS program in and of itself, preparing for a government shutdown during a disaster.
Yes.
What Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And it was, I was actually a student the week we closed because I didn't have a class in session in my program. I was able to go take a class in someone else's program. I was taking command and control of natural and man-made disasters with the intent of pulling pieces out of that course to build a new EMS course in pre-planning for natural disasters and pre-planning for target hazards. So I look around at what's already out there to use pieces of and build off of specific to EMS. So I was sitting through that class when this occurred, and my fellow students were quite concerned the night before as to what was going to happen to them. Were we just going to lock the gates, kick them out, and tell them, oh, well, too bad? But obviously in the background, there were plans on having buses ready to get them to the airports, being able to make sure they got a flight to the best of our ability in the middle of closing down, and trying to make sure nobody got left stranded standing at the gate hitching a ride. But we have those plans in place. There are people responsible for calling the bus company and getting them there, et cetera. But all that was done in the background. The students didn't even know it till 9 o'clock in the morning of the first when they were called together and said, here's the plan.
Wow. So who's the, what's the hierarchical structure there on the academy grounds? I think there was a gentleman by the name of O'Neill that was there when I went there.
Yes, Dr. Dennis O'Neill is the superintendent of the National Fire Academy, and he still is. I believe he's been here 18 years. His background is fire service, and came up through the fire service and then through education, and now is the superintendent. We have two deputy superintendents who manage, one manages the curriculum and instruction, one manages the administrative side, within the National Fire Academy itself. Alongside the National Fire Academy, we have National Fire Programs that does the prevention outreach, does the National Fire Incident Reporting System, NIFRS data collection, response liaison with the U.S. Fire Administration, correction, the U.S. Forest Service, since they and us share the ESF-4 function in federal emergency management for wild and fire for large fires across the nation. Above the National Fire Academy, National Fire Programs, we have the overarching U.S. Fire Administration, of which Chief Ernie Mitchell out of Los Angeles is currently the U.S. Fire Administrator, and Chief Glenn Gaines out of Fairfax, Virginia is the Deputy U.S. Fire Administrator.
I have a question on a different track, and Bill, your perspective would be of interest to me as well. And, you know, one part of the expense is certainly the travel and the lodging and the meals that the fire academy potentially covers, but another part of the expense is just paying somebody's time while they're away for a week of training. And especially if you're from a organization that doesn't have a tradition of sending, you know, rising leaders off to the fire academy for training, how do you make the case to your chief or your direct supervisor that going away for a week or two is going to be valuable for your organization, you know, both near term and long term? So I'm thinking of that sort of middle level supervisor that wants to go take a course. How do they sell it internally to get the permission to go?
Well, I'm just going to jump in there, and I can tell you that our organization has probably been using the National Fire Academy for over 20 years. And I would also say that almost every fire agency in our county has been sending people to the Fire Academy. We have many people that hold the EFO, Executive Fire Officer, credentials. And I would probably tell you everyone in our senior staff, chief level and above, has taken probably at least two classes, if not more, at the National Fire Academy. And we use it for a lot of our special ops training, but I know on the fire side they use it very extensively. And we we just cover the expense of the person while they're gone. You know, we know what the semesters are, and we just make plans for the person to be gone. And I can tell you that our county had 75 people or 100 people that participated in out at the Fire Academy for a 5-day program where they basically put our county through a tabletop disaster. I think we were struck by like 3 tornadoes, and but we had representatives of the city governments, county government, fire services, all sorts of agencies that went out there. And this is the second time in my 20 years here at in our county that we've participated in that level of a process there. And Mike, maybe you can tell us what they call that.
It sounds like you're referring to the Integrated Emergency Management course, which is actually in Emergency Management Institute, which shares the campus with us. Different chain of command, same campus, overall the same intent, except they're catering to the emergency management audience. We're catering to the fire and EMS audience. But you're right, that emergency management, integrated emergency management course brings together an entire municipality to practice disasters. We have a fictitious city, Central City, which is in the fictitious Liberty County in the fictitious state of Columbia, that you do not want to own property in. It is destroyed by hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, flooding, dam breaks, and I know I'm forgetting something, on a daily and weekly basis. And on the emergency management side, they run the emergency operations center, and all the different people have to be involved. They have the public information officer, a training and practice. On the National Fire Academy side, we use it for initial attack decision-making in the command and control courses. And now in our newest EMS courses, we have, using the same city with the same disasters, we have the mass casualty process, looking at the medical components of ICS and how to manage 100 triaged patients, or in our week-long class, almost 1,000 triaged patients in a week between the disasters.
But maybe I got to restate the question. Like, Bill, you're fortunate to be in a county where there's so much sort of historical inertia of sending people to the Fire Academy. And like Mike mentioned at the outset, there's still plenty of people in places that maybe are just hearing about this for the first time, and you know, they're going to be browsing the website and finding a course they want to take, and then rushing to see their chief or deputy chief and saying, I want to go take this course, and I'm going to be gone for a week, and the chief's going to say, whoa, you're not leaving for a week. Or I guess it could be that owner of that private service. What additional info or encouragement advice would you give to that person to sort of bolster their case that they're able to get not only the time away, but also hopefully to be paid as if they're on the job while they're at the National Fire Academy?
The thing I've been giving potential students or students that are going back and trying to recruit other students is a question. What is it that has made the difference in larger incidents and disasters between what we perceive as a failure and an incident that became a disaster or got worse, and those incidents and disasters that ran as well as you could expect it, and we did okay, and we managed it the best that we could? And the answer I give to that is training, education, and exercises. We need to learn about it. We need to learn the parts and pieces of it, and we need to practice it. And until we learn about it and we practice it to a best practice way, it may not be perfect for your agency because we're all slightly different, but there is a standard on how to do it. That's what you're going to bring back, is the experience in a fictitious city that you can come back and at least pull that thought out, pull that experience out, pull that memory out and say, I've done this before. Even though I was not at the X bombing or the Y shooting or the X hurricane, I experienced how it works in a fictitious city, and I can pull those pieces out to implement, provide training to my agency, provide the experience while the incident is going on in my jurisdiction, instead of it being the first time ever.
Excellent. Thank you for that. We are amazingly nearing the end of our hour together. So with that, Rob, do you have a final question for Mike?
No, but that's been really interesting, and especially nice to hear that the Academy is open to international visitors as well. I just one thing out of curiosity, do you offer the advanced hazmat life support program there, or is that too much of a sort of frontline provider type course?
We don't offer that advanced hazmat life support, as it is somebody else's program, University right. of Arizona, I believe.
Okay.
So that's their program. In our hazardous materials program, we do have advanced life support response to hazardous materials incidents, which is the same but very different from the University of Arizona's program. Our program is 2 weeks long, is about 50% pharmacology, toxicology, and 50% hazardous material chemistry. And then there's a tie together of how of applying that toxicology to the chemistry for the hazmat technicians.
That sounds very interesting.
Rob, do you have something comparable to this in Canada?
I have to plead ignorant on that
okay.
one. I know we have some sort of training center in Ottawa or near Ottawa, which is the nation's capital, right. but it's outside my area of expertise. And we have an EMAT team, an emergency medical assistance team, which has expertise on and rapid deployment plans for disasters. But I'd have to plead ignorance on that one.
Okay, sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah, no problem.
Bill, how about you? A final question or comment for Mike?
Mike, thank you for taking the opportunity to be with all of us here tonight and share more of the National Fire Academy. It's an excellent opportunity, and I hope you are able to get more people involved to experience it. It's a wonderful experience for people to have.
Well, thank you all for having me. I truly appreciate the opportunity to talk to all of your listeners and share what we have. I didn't know it was here. Hopefully one of your listeners will now know it's here.
Well, and if you're hearing about this for the first time and you end up in a program, when you get there, make sure you tell Mike that you heard about it first on the EMS Educast, and then Mike closed the loop with Bill and Rob and I. Is there anything that we didn't get to that you were hoping to share, a final thought you have on the Fire Academy and the EMS programs before we go to the closing of the show?
I would love to tell you all about all the courses and all the fun things that we do, but time is at its limit.
Uh-huh.
So probably the biggest thing I'd like to just reemphasize is we do have classes available, seats available. Take a look at our website at the courses. If you have questions, get in touch with me. I can provide email address to make it easy.
Yeah, what's the best way for listeners to contact you?
Truly, I have a phone, but I don't sit at my desk very much. The okay. best way to get a hold of me is email.
All right.
Michael, and that is Michael, MICHAEL, .Stern, STERN, at FEMA, .DHS, .gov.
Okay.
I was waiting for another dot.
Well, we just, that's all we have for now.
So, Mike,
let's make a note on Rob's file next time he tries to cross the border in the U.S.
I'm making funny of email addresses and government agencies. I'm curious, are people reluctant to sign up for courses with the looming debt ceiling having to be raised again in, what is it, January?
January 15th. I have received that question from students scheduled for that week and students applying for that week, and we don't know. We know we have a plan if it happens. That's the best I can offer. Please try to come out.
You should pick it on at Congress and just tell them, you guys better raise the debt ceiling, get your act together.
Well, the real action item is to contact your elected officials and
of course
continue to remind them that their shenanigans affect people's real lives. And but I don't want to get all wound up again. I'm still cooling off after what happened a few weeks ago. Gentlemen, we've reached the part of the show where we like to end with an endorsement, a recommendation, you know, something that you want educators everywhere to know about. And Rob, are you ready to kick us off?
Sure. Yeah, I have an app to recommend, which is a complete and utter departure from what we've been talking about tonight. It's an app called VideoScribe, and you can actually download the software on a desktop or laptop or the app on an iOS device. Now, I'm not sure if it's available for Android, but it's by a company called Sparkle, S-P-A-R-K-O-L. And if you've ever seen those videos on YouTube where they have whiteboard animation with really fast drawing, well, VideoScribe replicates that in like a non-stop motion capture style of drawing. So it's very cool. You just select the drawing items to, and then you narrate them, and it looks like you've created a TED Talk video. Very cool.
Wow, fantastic. We'll check that out, and I've got their link. I'll put that in the show notes. Bill, do you have something that you want to recommend and share?
Well, I'm gonna continue to put the plug in the American Heart Association's Resuscitation Science Symposium is happening here in November, and I think it's the – well, while I do that, look that up. But I really want to encourage people that if you're looking to really find out the cutting aspects of what's going on with resuscitation of medical and trauma patients, to be around and listen to the latest stuff in a two-day condensed format – and meet with the really great people that are doing all of the work, I strongly encourage you to participate in this. And again, if you don't make it this year, make it next year. It continues to grow. It has an international audience that participates in it. It's just an absolutely wonderful experience. And it's the 16th and 17th of November. It's in Dallas, Texas, the home of the American Heart Association. Yes, you can still register for it. It's, again, very good use of your 2 days' worth of time. And I've been going now probably 5-6 years, I think. I can't remember for sure, but it's one of those conferences that I just believe is essential to go to stay out there on the cutting edge.
Excellent. Thanks for sharing that. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. And I should, on a related note, I posted a link. The Heart Association is hiring a senior manager at education design and implementation for their emergency cardiovascular care program. And it occurred to me that if that position could be filled by somebody that's been and taught paramedics, it could really change BLS and ACLS and PALS instruction. And so a listener maybe should look at that and find their way to get that job, because I just would be delighted if that was a paramedic that ended up with that job. So you can find that at facebook.com/EMSEducast, and then Bill will add your recommendation to the show notes. Mike, I know we didn't give you much time to plan or think of something, but do you have an event, a book, an app, or something that you want to recommend educators to check out?
I'll give you something that's not necessarily specific to educators, unfortunately, but to fire an EMS service, and there is an EMS component to it. Many people are familiar with the Field Operations Guide, the FOG, or ICS. It's kind of the pocket Bible to setting up your organizational structure and responsibilities for all the command staff position, general staff positions. There is a new electronic version. The U.S. Fire Administration created an electronic web-based version that is available now and the final stages of an Android and iPad app are being approved as we speak.
Okay.
I don't know how soon the app will be out. I've seen the demo, so it exists, but the web-based already does exist.
Great.
The website is also plenty of dots. We have it hosted on someone else's website.
Okay. Do you want to just send me the link and I'll put it in the show notes?
I can do that. I'll send it to you, but it's the web-based field operations guide, so you can scroll through with bookmarks and find such as the multi-casualty organization chart to set up that medical branch if that's what you need.
Excellent. Thanks. That's good to hear that that's going to be available as an app as well. My recommendation is more of a recollection, and I guess somewhat related to this topic. Earlier today, I was reading a newspaper article, and I realized that it was 20 years ago today that I was a student and a member of the University of Wisconsin Marching Band. It was a Saturday afternoon, October 30th. The Wisconsin Badgers had just beat the Michigan Wolverines for the first time, I want to say, in several decades. And at the end of the game, as the marching band, as we were taking the field, the student sections, O and P, when the stands surged to rush the field and attempt to tear down the goalposts. And in that excitement and that surge of the crowd, the lower rows of students pressed up against the fence. And, it's a 70 rows of humanity moving downhill very quickly, and as I reread the article today, there was dozens of students that were injured and 10 that were seriously injured and even some that were unresponsive. And I remember at the time reading about how one of the football players ended up performing CPR on one of the students that had been crushed in that incident. And so that mass casualty incident from my past has been on my mind this afternoon, and it was a really sort of interesting perspective I had because I was at the field level that afternoon, and so being out on the field actually was a terrible vantage point to see, I guess, the chaos and the injured that I was actually really close to because I was on the field level. And you can't really see much when you're in a huge crowd of people. And the band, we ended up being evacuated out the south end of the stadium, I'm pretty sure, instead of our usual north end route, or we left the stadium very quickly. And so they could bring ambulances and rescue personnel onto the football field. And 20 years ago was, before cell phones and before Twitter and Facebook and all that. And it was actually several hours later when I was out for dinner that I started to see video and news reports of what had actually happened so nearby, because like I said, we had been at field level and then evacuated and didn't watch it all unfold. And, as I attend different mass casualty presentations and different types of incidents, at least that's a sort of historical incident that rarely comes up, maybe because there wasn't any actual fatalities, but that sort of mass gathering and trauma from sudden movements of large groups of people, we don't hear about it happening a whole lot in the United States, maybe more overseas. But anyway, I just wanted to share my recollection of being there that afternoon, and then it sort of flooding back into my mind this afternoon. And I have a link and a blog post that I wrote that I'll share in the show notes as well. But that was 20 years ago at Camp Randall Stadium in Madison, Wisconsin.
Cool.
Yeah, I seem to have a knack, I think, to be nearby at these events, because I was in Reno when the air show crash happened, and I was in Boston this spring. I don't know.
So we shouldn't hang out with you. Is that
I don't know. It's,
but you're a near miss every
proximity, time. Proximity, yeah. Proximity.
Or a remote miss.
And what I like to tell people that are nervous about flying, I say, I know a guy that was on the plane that landed in the Hudson. And so, you know, what are the odds that I know somebody? So, you know, I feel like I can fly safely for the rest of my life.
Okay.
So, Mike, Rob, Bill, thanks so much for humoring me with that long story. And it's been a real pleasure to talk this evening.
Thank you, Greg.